Welcome, welcome, welcome to another wonderful Culture of Comics podcast brought to you by the AMVG Radio Network. I am your host today, Jason Frazier, and with me as always is the Dick Grayson Robin to my Batman, Stephen Heiner. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you very much.
We are now on our second independent show today, and we're very, very happy to be here today. I think we're going to have some very, very interesting topics, some very good books, some very odd books. I'll say that up front, Stephen. There's some very weird ones today. Very, very weird ones. I think we're going to get very adult books, I would say, overall. And I don't know if you have, I know you haven't had a chance to read some of them quite yet, but hopefully I can convince you to jump on the board because some of them are very, very good. And I think we're probably going to start off with what is arguably one of the bigger books out right now. Everywhere you look or everywhere you go into a comic book shop, you're going to hear a conversation about this book. And people will try to get you on board with it. And I was kind of pulled into one of those. I say, well, you should read this book. And they describe it to me, and I'm thinking, this book sounds bizarre. I don't know about this book. But for those who are not reading it yet, we're going to start talking about the book Saga by writer Brian K. Vaughan. Currently the artist is Fiona Staples, and it's very, very good art, by the way. I know we like to talk about art on this show quite a bit, Stephen. I think this is some art you could really get right into, so to speak. I think you would really like it. And Miss Staples, the artist, really gets to expand her horizons with this book because let me explain what Saga's about. For those who are not reading it yet, and for those who are, you already know what I'm talking about. This book is like, it's got robots and magic and alien species and politics and robots and interplanetary travel, and it is, I would say, one of the more adult books I've ever read. I can tell you this, Stephen, because when you open up that first page, the first page is a woman giving birth. It's the first thing you get out of this book. And,
wow.
It just gets crazier from there. For the record, the story centers around two people, but I guess they're not really, named Alana and Marco, and they are from two separate species. Alana is from, I believe it's called the Coalition of Landfall, which is one of the biggest planets in the galaxy in this world. And she is of a species that have wings and can fly. So kind of like a giant fairy with green hair. Marco is from the moon, from Landfall's moon called Reef. I've forgotten already, but they have antlers, horns, like a ram goat. And the premise is that these two are star-crossed lovers. It's essentially Romeo and Juliet in space with a lot of cursing and lasers and all kinds of cool stuff. But very, very adult, I will say this, for those who are not jumping on board, who maybe shy away from some very adult topics and language, this is probably not the book for you, but if you're willing to give it a chance, I think you'd like it. The book begins with Alana and Marco having a child, an interspecies child, which is obviously something that concerns a lot of people on both planets, since they are at war with one another. They're not really biggest friends. They kind of hate each other. I believe that it's Alana's species, the winged species, uses Marco's species as slaves. And so not the best thing to build a relationship on from the beginning, I can tell you that, Stephen. It's a little rough start. And actually, Alana is guarding Marco in a prison, and she breaks him out. They have relations and conceive a child, and this is where the story begins. They're trying to escape from the war and kind of raise their family, protect their daughter. But there are some very weird, very odd visuals throughout this book. For example, they are currently traveling through space on a spaceship that they pulled out of it's a spaceship forest. There's no other way to put it. A spaceship forest. Spaceships grow like trees. So this is a wooden spaceship that flying is based on. It's sentient. It's a tree. It's a flying tree. I don't know how else to put it, Steve, but it's a little twisted.
Okay. So it's like Groot with rocket engines.
Yes, exactly. It's like Guardians of the Galaxy with more cursing and sex. That's what this book is like. But it is a fantastic book. Brian K. Vaughan, he's not afraid of big ideas. And I know that you mentioned in the pre-show that you were looking at reading some of his other work, and that's, I believe, Why the Last Man, which is a fantastic series. Have you started reading that yet, or are you going to be working towards it?
No, no, it's going to go into my giant pile of trade paperbacks.
Well, I think once you start that, you're going to be hooked. And I think, again, it depends on what if you're comfortable with the ideas they're presenting here. I know there's very, like I said, there's some adult things. It's very, very mature book. I know that, for example, Alana and Marco are being hunted by bounty hunters from the robot empire, who look to kind of work with the winged species to control the horned species, Marco's species. And they hire bounty hunters, and one of the bounty hunters we follow, who goes by the name The Will, and it's bizarre when they say his name in the comic book because they keep using the every time before his name. How are you doing, The Will? So it's interesting, but he actually is an issue or two where he is on a, how do I want to put this? I'll put it as delicately as possible. It's essentially a sex planet, like a prostitution planet. And
so
he
it's
stays
a
sick. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But there's some uncomfortable aspects to it, because I know that he gets placed in a room with a six-year-old slave, and essentially he rescues this young girl because he's the hero of the story in this case. And some of that kind of stuff, some of the ideas presented will probably make some people uncomfortable, I think. And I think you might agree. It's kind of like when you read it, you're like, I don't know about this. But I assure you, if you give this book a chance, if you take a look at it, you're going to like it. You just have to be able to deal with some very, I would say, some uncomfortable ideas in some cases. And I think that's Brian K. Vaughan's trademark, because he, with his Why the Last Man, it's essentially that he is the last man on the planet, and he's, all the ladies want him, but not in the way that we'd like to think, I'll tell you that. But this, I described this book a month ago on our first independent show as kind of a cross between Star Wars and Game of Thrones, I think is a good example. And I think that still holds true, because you're seeing a lot of politics, you're following stories from different points of view, like you're following the stories from the bad guys of the story as well. So you're getting a life, the bad guy of the story is Prince Robot the Fourth. That's actually his name, and he's a robot, exactly what it sounds like. He's a bad guy, but you kind of get to know him, and you don't hate the guy. And I think that's what kind of makes this book effective, is you're much like the Game of Thrones, which is a huge thing right now. You get to like all the characters. Now, there's a few characters in Game of Thrones I think everybody hates, but Prince Robots, that wouldn't be one of these characters you hate. The robots, the designs, like I said, the visuals in this book are very, very unique. They're humanoid, but they have televisions for heads. And so when they have an extreme emotion, they'll project an image onto there. Did you get to read about the controversy around issue 12, Stephen?
I did. I did a little bit in my show research. And that's interesting. It was one of the play. You know, you always think when you're talking about sexual issues and Apple, you're usually thinking about pornography through the iTunes store. You know, you're not going to find that in the apps, and you're not going to find that for sale. And this is just a business decision that Apple made a long time ago, which obviously can change, but that it applied directly here to this to issue 12, I guess.
It does. And for the record, issue 12 depicts how delicately you want to put this one. It depicts on Prince Robot the Fourth's face when he is shot. It depicts a picture of what appears to be gay pornography, and some people may not be comfortable with that kind of thing. And you know, to each their own. And that's my whole point about this book, is that it can be challenging for some people. If you're willing to work through the challenges, I personally have no problem with any of it so far. But very little offends me. So if you can work through some of this stuff and realize it's all part of a story, I think you're in for a real treat with this book, because it's very good. You get a lot of low-key moments that are about a new family just starting out, but you've also got this intergalactic war going on. and you've got bounty hunters. You've got all the trappings of a Star Wars movie, maybe the dirty version of a Star Wars movie. But again, I think we talk about sometimes how comic books can challenge people, and I think this is one book with some of its ideas, some of its language, some of its even with depictions of what it shows can challenge some people. So again, it's up to you. I wouldn't shove this book on any of my listeners or even you, Stephen, but I think it's worth a look for anybody. But there's just some very, very cool moments throughout the whole book. I know that currently the storyline is that they are on their wooden spaceship in space, and Marco's parents have come in and met their new daughter-in-law and a new granddaughter. And it doesn't initially go as well as you would think. So, why are you with that person? Why are you with one of them? You know, but just like anything, when I see a grandchild, when grandparents meet the grandchild, it melts the heart, but it's a good story. It's very, again, very low-key, but there's a lot of politics going on in the background too, Stephen. There really is. There's an author that has written a subversive book. It's kind of a coded book. It's a story about... it's like a romance novel, but people are using it as propaganda to talk about a resistance. And so they're going to meet actually, I believe the next issue, I thought it was going to be out before the show, but it's not. I haven't been able to find it yet, so it may not be out yet. Didn't see it in the store, didn't see it on the digital app yet, but they're going to go meet this artist. And I can't wait to see where the story's going to go here, because I think we're going to be seeing a lot of political machinations, a lot of family moments. A lot of bizarre things, because the designs on some of these characters, I think you would just find. I know you're a fan of art, Stephen. I think you would really like this art and just the visuals behind it. If nothing else, that may be something that may hook you just to look at the book and not even read it. Who knows? But I think it challenges a lot of people. But I like a challenge, so to speak. So I think it's very, very deep. I have given you a very superficial description of this book so far today, but I can tell you that there's layers upon layers so far, and it's going to be very interesting to see where it goes. I can't wait for you to get to it. I know you're going to go through The Why the Last Man first. Again, if you have not read that, anybody, any of our listeners, that's definitely one you want to take a look at too. But Saga is ongoing now. I think they're only on issue 12, and 13 should be out any day now, sometime, I swear. And I'm kind of anxiously awaiting it, because I actually picked up Saga maybe 2 months ago. So it's a fairly new book to me, and I had to catch up right away because I was just kind of hooked in. And I want to ask you, I know that Stephen has not got to read it yet, but like I said, it's in his pile, so I want to ask your opinion on it. But again, I think it's something you'd like. It's a challenging book in a lot of ways. Content-wise, those are not easy challenges to overcome, but I think it's worth a look for anybody who's looking for something very interesting and just a little weird. I know I've said this before, but it's not a superhero book. You know, there's no superheroes. This is there's war and things are ugly. So, but for ugly, it sure does look pretty. I'll tell you that.
Well, I've got a couple questions for you about it, Jason.
Sure.
Let me back up for a second, because I told you in the pre-show that this was recommended to me, and if you listened to Jason's very first part of the show, he talked about it being everywhere, and it is everywhere. You can't go to anything that has anything to do with comics and not hear about Saga. Everyone is talking about it. It's really, really big. So obviously I had asked about it, and I heard the description, Star Wars meets Game of Thrones, which, of course, I love both of those things, so I thought, okay, well, I'm in. But I think at the time I had just reached about 30 pulls a month, and I had started to be really strict about adding new books. And I had made an exception for Hawkeye at that point, and I went to 31 or something, and I'm at 33. So I don't know how firm my line was at 30. So maybe I might increase the number to 35 and take on Saga. But I think let me ask you, Jason, as someone who tends to pull a lot of books, if you're talking about, I think I have a bigger question here about what makes you decide to subscribe to a book. Do you read a few issues before you subscribe? Do you get a trade paperback? And I know it's different for every book, but when you're looking at the process of adding yet another book to your weekly pile, what informs that? And was Saga part of that process, or did you like it so much that first? So I can say that was how it was for me with Hawkeye. I bought the trade paperback, and I thought, well, I'll see how the trade paperback goes, and then I'll buy the next trade paperback. Well, no, I liked that so much, I went and bought all the back issues. I wasn't going to wait for the trade paperback. So that was my process for Hawkeye. Maybe you could speak to a bit.
Yeah.
Someone like myself who's like, well, thanks, Jason, and I like Star Wars, and I like Game of Thrones like Steven, but I don't know about adding one more book to the pile.
I think it's a very valid point. I think, let me tell you, you're right. People, like I said, that's kind of how that book was approached to me as well. It's this and this combined with a little bit of Romeo and Juliet thrown in, and I'm thinking those three things are pretty, at this point, pretty classic. I think even Game of Thrones, which is fairly new as a TV series, granted the books have been around for a while, I would consider that a classic series already. I think that's going to stand for the ages. All Star Wars, Game of Thrones, Romeo and Juliet, you can't go wrong with any of those things, combining them into one. But I heard about this, and I thought, in my process, I actually was able to go onto the Image digital application and get the first issue for free, for the record. For those of you who just may want to give it a try, and you utilize the digital app, you can actually read that first issue for free off of that application on your iPad or your iPhone even. I assume Android devices as well. So that, in those cases, Stephen, when I have the opportunity to take a look at the first issue for free, I'll take advantage of that. I kind of go both ways, though, with that. I can read the first issue. If I can't do that, I might just buy the trade paperback because I'm always willing to try new things. And I think what sells this book for me is that it was so unique in how it's approached. It's such a different book from everything else that I read. We talked about before, and I know I hate to, we don't want to always mention the other publishers when we're talking about independents, for example, but I read a lot of Marvel. I read a lot of superhero stuff. I read a lot of DC, and so, but those are superhero books at their core at the end of the day, and this is not. This is something very different, and I was just looking for something different. You know, sometimes you can read about a million issues of Avengers and Superman and just go, okay, I need something. I need something to cleanse the palate, so to speak. And that's kind of what this book provided for me. It was such a unique, I don't want to say experience, I don't want to over-dramatize what's going on here. This is a good book in general, but it didn't change my life, but it's a good book. So I was lucky enough to be able to, but again, you can check out the digital applications. You can actually find a lot of first issues of several series on there. Another one we're going to be talking about today, Chew, also has the first issue available on the digital application for free. And I think that's a good move on publishers' parts because, you know, Stephen, that gives them a chance, new readers potentially, a chance to
try
the series and get an idea and things like it. Yeah, I think that's foolproof. I think if as long as it's not an issue that came out last month, and we're talking about now we're in our 12th issue, don't be afraid to maybe give something away to get a little something back. And in this case, they got a reader out of me, and I'm sure several other people.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's an incredibly smart business move because they can't sell. Those issues are out of print, so it's not like they're losing money. So it's a
right.
give-to-get idea. I love it. It's a very good business idea.
It's worked out well. I know that at the end of the day, we talked about digital last week, how we would kind of we use ours as kind of a point of reference or go back to read stuff I've already read later. But this also, if you're using digital applications now, I still prefer the feel of paper in my hands, but the digital supplements that for me. It allows me to pick up new things and get a taste for it first and then decide if I want to jump in. I can tell you after I read that first issue, for example, I went and picked up the first trade paperback and the next six issues that were out of that. Well, let's just say the next, with that point, four issues that were out. And for those who get interested in this book, I can tell you that I believe at this point, either this week or next, the second trade paperback with issues 6 through 12 should be in stores, the local comic book store. So it is out. The first one's already out. So I would suggest if you have access to the digital application, you take a look at that first issue, see if it's something that you want to know what happens next kind of thing, and follow it up from there. Just pick up trades at this point unless you have the opportunity to pick up some individual issues because I'm a big fan of having all the story in one place myself too, so I got to tell you that. When I can get a trade, that I like to do that for some of the stuff that I am behind on or wasn't reading before it started. If I didn't get on board at the ground level, I got to pick up some trades and catch up. But just a fascinating series, even, and I think very, very different from what you and I both normally read. Now, you read The Massive. We talked about that last independent, and of course we talked about some of the other books. I think independent books have the opportunity to challenge us, and I guess today challenge is my word that I'm going to use a million times. But independent books have a way, the opportunity to challenge us in ways that the big corporations' books, like Marvel and DC, can't. They really can't do this. And so this is definitely one that you're going to be interested in. I think it's got a good story at its heart. It's a very simple story, I think, right now. But the way they choose to present it is very different. And I like that. I like it's just, where else are you going to get robots, magic, aliens, wooden spaceships, and baby mama drama, you know, all together in one book. So it's definitely interesting. And like I said, Stephen, I can't wait for you to start reading it. So maybe we can come back to Saga in one of the future shows and just kind of catch up and see how we're doing with it. Because I think I know many people who listen to the show probably already read it. And for those who aren't, if you pick it up today, you'll know what we're talking about next time. So Saga, again, very adult, very cool, though. Not one I would pick up for your 8-year-old to read, but something as an adult or a mature reader that you would really enjoy. Stephen, I think we're going to go on to the next topic today. And this one I think you might know a little bit about. Let's take a look here. We're going to talk about Fatal next. Fatal. And since you actually, I wasn't reading this book until we talked about the Independent show last month, and you mentioned that it was one you were reading. I started reading it then. So I'm going to let you kind of describe it for the readers, if you don't, or the listeners, pardon me, who, if you don't mind, kind of get us up to date on where we're at, and we can talk about it.
Absolutely. Fatal's written by Ed Brubaker and has art done by Sean Phillips, and those two are a dynamic duo of their own. They do a lot of work together. And I got pulled into the book by a chance comment on an old Batman one-shot from 2010, in which Ed Brubaker did the story. So I'm a huge Captain America fan, and Ed Brubaker's had a really great run on, he's no longer writing the current Captain America book. But I mentioned that I like that. I really like the Batman one-shot that he did. And so my local comic shop owner said, hey, why don't you check out Fatal? So I went over, and I flipped through a couple pages, and I was really interested by the art. I like the noir genre. For those of you who are wondering, you know, what kind of book this is, it's a L.A. Confidential 1950s detective story in a way, but with references to ages before the 1950s, if I even want to put it in that time period. And I got the trade paperback after I flipped through a few issues, and I was really interested. It is not it's not a book that motivates you in the same way as, again, I would say, I'm trying to think of issues, books that I read the day that they come out, Jason, and All New X-Men would be there, Hawkeye would be there.
I'm sure.
So Fatal is not, it's not written in a way where you need to grab the next issue immediately. It's a long story. It has a long strategy, and you get that from the beginning. You read, and you think to yourself, well, I hope they explain that. And they will. It's going to take a while. And you really get a sense of the vision here of what that means. And it's interesting because I think I got to see a bit of what Ed Brubaker did so well with Captain America. He would also take you on these very long stories, but it was within, let's say, the Marvel construct. Well, in Image, they don't care about that stuff. So when I say they care about that stuff, the way Marvel would prefer maybe episodic issues, Fatal doesn't care about that. And they don't care if there's not a cliffhanger at the end of the last book. That's not what is compelling. If you're compelled by the story, you're going to want to read. You're going to want to keep reading. This is somewhat similar to, I would say, the early episodes of Breaking Bad, and shows like that, where you're having to relearn how to watch a show because of what the producers and the writers are trying to do. So Fatal is about a woman who seems to have what do you want to call it? Nick Fury, Wolverine, juice. She has the Infinity Formula. Nah, we have to stop making our Marvel references. We're not on our Marvel show today. So she's drinking.
Stop it.
who knows whatever she has, but it's clear that she has a power over men, which she doesn't necessarily just use sexually. She doesn't have to undress or anything. She has this mind control power over men, and it seems that she is immortal, or at least she has lived for quite some time. We don't get a sense that she's been around for forever. She did come into existence at some recent point, but that she is now endowed with that gift. And what we're looking at in the first 10 issues, which is where I'm through, I read the first two trade paperbacks. Right now we're through issue 14, and those are in my giant pile. And I'll catch up for this week, and I don't mean mustard. And the first 10 issues are focused on her story as told by a guy who's a writer. So there's a lot of retrospective, and the 11 through 14 is a flashback sequence. So I'm just talking about issues 1 through 10. Origins, not quite an origin story, but an origin story of where the story is right now. And they did a lot of building that out for us. There's a cult involved with a very, I'm going to say, sinister reference to the Church of Scientology. And has its basis in the 1970s religious revival groups in L.A. There's some historical ties to this. There's also sort of current-day commentary. And I think within the character herself, there is the sense of what is, how can I put this, not quite a boredom with being immortal, but she senses there's something wrong with it. Is that a fair introduction, Jason?
I would agree. I think this character, the very, very tragic character, right? From her perspective, you say she got a power over men. It's a power that she does not choose to exercise, but it does tend to happen. And whether she wants, and that's why I believe in your second story arc in issue 6, she's kind of isolated herself in Hollywood, up in the hills, trying to just stay away and have them stumble across a gentleman, and it all begins again. As you said, there's kind of, it's interesting. And once you start reading 10 through, or I should say 11 through 14, you're probably going to get a sense, Stephen, that she's been around a lot longer than we thought. I am beginning to form a little bit of an opinion on what she is or what she might be. Because these stories, what's interesting about the last three or four issues is that these are far more episodic than the previous issues. Each one goes to a different time period and discusses her interactions in a different time period. I believe it's a Wild West one. There's definitely a medieval one, even a World War II one. So there's what's so fascinating is there is a mystery behind all this, and the mystery, I think, is what probably hooks a lot of us in. We're like, what is happening with this book, and who is she? What is she? I think you described it right. She's a tragic character. I think that she has been around a long time. I wouldn't call it boredom per se, but just a desire to not hurt the world around her, not hurt the people. Because every time that she is around a gentleman who falls under her spell, I'm using quotation marks for those who can't see me, which is everybody, her spell, essentially, they're under her spell until they die, and essentially it's a cycle that keeps repeating itself. And I think she's very tired of the cycle. She at some point she get the impression, if not loves, isn't a big huge pile of like with some of these men. And so to see them go so crazy and eventually fall down the path they all eventually fall down is probably very painful for her as an immortal being. But, this is the first story takes place, like you said, probably the 50s, roughly. I would say that there is a framing device around this of this original character and issue, the original gentleman we meet in the 50s, his grandson, or I don't know, I forget what exactly his relation is. He's the framing device at this point for the story. I would say he's the main gentleman character, besides her, he's the main character. He's the one who's kind of dealing with her in a current day. And I believe in our next arc, we're going to see that she actually does take place in current day again. So we'll be able to kind of catch up. But you'll like, you haven't got to read those other issues yet, but I think you really like those next issues. They are all kind of one and done stories, but they all take place in a different time period. And so she's been around for quite some time.
Her, and I know we've kept referring to her as that woman, but her name is Josephine. She sometimes goes by Jo, and it really, I suppose, is all about her.
Yeah.
As the name suggests.
Really, I believe, yeah. I think that she's, well, I think it's very clear that there's demonic forces after her at this point, and I suspect, I don't know, I like to kind of guess where things are going, and I suspect that she herself is probably something like, for those who know the demonic names, she could be something like Eve. I shouldn't say Eve wasn't a demon, but she could be Eve, or she could be Lilith. I get the impression that these demons want her back for something. They're trying to find her, and I think that she is bigger than anybody's really guessed so far. She's somebody important. Maybe a succubus, something along those lines. But I don't think that she's not even aware of what she really is anymore, I don't think. I don't get that impression. Do you think so, Stephen?
No. No.
I really like, and what's interesting about Brubaker and Phillips is they have done stories very similar to this. I think if anybody hasn't read other issues that are, for example, like Incognito, Criminal, some of the other stuff they've done, these guys seem to like to do kind of noir stories. It seems to be their wheelhouse. And even, I think we could even argue, and again, I'm sorry I'd have to go back and reference Marvel again, but I think someone could argue even the Captain America run from Brubaker had a lot of noirish aspects to it. So Brubaker is very good at writing this. He's in his wheelhouse with this kind of story, and he's found his muse, so to speak, in Sean Phillips. I think that they do tend to do very well together. I'm very excited to see where this book goes, though, and I think you're right. It's not one you read right away, but I can tell you this, Stephen. It's a book that when I read, I think about afterwards. I'm like, just trying to figure out what's happening. I really think about where they're going to go with the story. It leaves you wanting more because they, like you said, Image tells their story here, I would say, in a very decompressed way. Now, there's good decompression and bad decompression. I would argue decompression is at its worst with The Walking Dead, and that's my make people mad comment of the day. That's decompressed to the point of being very boring to me. But Fatale, it tells enough story to leave me wanting a lot more. Like, I wish it was just I almost wish I could travel 5 years in the future and see what happened, you know, because it's very interesting. And I think the way they're choosing to tell the story is very good, because I think, again, this is another one. If you go into a comic book store, you ask your owner or you ask someone who reads comic books, you might get this as a reference. This is another one that I would think is, in my opinion, is fairly big right now. There's a lot of discussion about it amongst the comic book fans who venture outside of the big two. So it's definitely worth a look. I can't wait for you to catch up. Again, I'd like to come back to. I think eventually we're going to want to come back to all these books, because I hope by that point some of our listeners will have read some of this stuff. We'd love to hear from some of you eventually about what you think about some of these stories, because I know this is our thoughts about this. I'd love to hear some outside thoughts as well, whether you agree or disagree, or maybe just to tell me how wrong I am about what I'm guessing. That would be pretty cool. But I think,
and there are all sorts of ways you can get a hold of us. You can respond to our, you can send us a direct message on Twitter. That's at twitter.com/AMDG Radio, and just refer to the Culture of Comics show. Facebook.com/AMDG Radio. You can write on our wall, or you can send us a message there, or you can use good old-fashioned email. I love that email is old-fashioned now. AMDGradio @gmail.com. You can email us. And obviously also feel free to leave your comments in the iTunes store under AMDG Radio if you feel comfortable leaving a rating for us, as long as it's good. Leave a rating for us there. And if you have some challenges or complaints, please feel free to let us know how we can improve the show for you. And we'll do that. And as Jason said, I think we can incorporate that into future shows.
We'd love to hear from you. I think it would be everyone might have some very different ideas or some challenges for us. And I would love to have a conversation, not a fight, but a conversation about some of these things. Any final thoughts about Fatale before we move on, Stephen?
As I was told as to how I picked up PayPal, go look. Both trade paperbacks are out. Look at the first issue. If it at all interests you, go to the trade, and if you like it, go from there.
Good advice. You can't go wrong. For those who are just joining us, you are listening to the Culture of Comics podcast on the AMDG Radio Network. I am your host, Jason Frazier, and with me, as always, is Stephen Heiner. We have just finished talking about the books Saga and Fatale, two very, very good books. And if you have not listened yet, go back and listen to that part. We'll wait. but for the next part of our show, we're going to go into a topic, or I would call it almost a universe in and of itself, very, very dear to me. This is one I probably would fight some people on, because I grew up with this to an extent. Obviously, I was through my teenage years, and it's very, very dear. I even go back and watch some of the shows for this gentleman quite a bit. I'm a big fan of the shows, and that, of course, is the Joss Whedon Buffy the Vampire Slayer universe. For those who don't know, Joss Whedon, the writer, director of the Avengers movie, something you may have heard of back in last summer. If you didn't, I want to know how the weather was under that rock. But otherwise, it is, I would say Joss Whedon has presented a very unique voice. I would say the voice of the voice of a generation. His writing style is very unique, and I think he's going to be, I would already consider him an A-list director, writer. But he had, of course, a couple of shows on TV several years ago that you may be aware of, and that was, of course, Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel. Now, big fan of this. My sister-in-law, Rachel, and I could sit down and watch hours of this show, just days and days on DVD over and over again. Buffy the Vampire Slayer was on the air for, I believe, goodness, 7 seasons on the networks, and Angel was on for 5. What I think is interesting, though, Stephen, what they've done here is that there was so much love and just general passion about the show that what they've done is they've actually continued the show in comic book form. They've taken the show into season 8 about a year ago, and season 5, respectively. They are continuing the show in comic book format. It's got all the same canon. It picks up where the last episode left off. I think that's a fascinating approach, and I think they could do that with many more shows that maybe have some love behind it that got canceled before their time. It gives us fans another way to keep our addiction going. Currently, Buffy is actually now in season 9. I love that they actually call it seasons on the comic books too. Buffy season 8, Buffy season 9. There's no pretense. This is just an immediate continuation of the show. I can't think of anything else that's really done that, but I'm sure there are. Can you think of something that's continued after the TV show, kind of like the other seasons in different formats?
Well, we talked a little bit in the pre-show that the current Star Trek run on IDW is running along the same time. And one of the things I love about Planet of the Apes is it's within that universe, so it respects the canon. It's not doing things after the Planet of the Apes movies, but it's within and around that universe. But I don't think anyone is doing, as you say, explicitly seasons, et cetera. The only other one I can think of is Game of Thrones, who I think Moon is doing that, but they're just doing a straight comic book version of the TV show. So there's no difference there at all, whereas here what you're talking about is new content. I'm interested to know if Joss Whedon is part of the creative team of the book.
I can tell you that he was for at least the first portion of season 8, and he does. I almost want to say, I don't know if there's a job like this in the comic book writer's format, but he's almost the producer of this comic book. He oversees it. He kind of puts his approval down on where things are going. He's handed, I can tell you that some of the people who are writing it or were writing it were actually writers on the show originally. So initially, this was very much a labor of love from those who were doing the show. It's kind of moved on to different writers now. But they all have the approval and the direction. They all try to respect what Joss Whedon created. And so I can tell you that if you did not watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer, if you picked up issue 1 of season 8, at first you're going to be a little lost, because it expects this book is really for those who enjoy this universe. And I know there's a lot of you. Maybe you don't want to admit it, or maybe admit it out loud, but it's there. This was a fantastic show. And so far, a fantastic comic book. What I like about this idea, Stephen, what I like about these two, and of course, Buffy and Angel are two separate comic books. You've got two, and for two separate series, respectively. But what I like about this is that now he's able to tell stories that are much bigger because he's not working off a television budget. You're working off of a comic book format, which allows for incredible special effects.
Right. Well, so you can do things. You can do things in the comic book format that might be too expensive to do in the TV show format.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so we dealt with season eight. Actually, dealt with a villain named Twilight. It also dealt with Buffy dealing with what was amounted to an army of slayers. Because at the end of, if somebody who watched the TV show may remember that she, in order to beat the bad guy at the end of that season, she activated all the slayers in the world. Usually there's one slayer a generation, but there's several, and when one dies, another one comes. Another one's activated, so to speak. But she actually used a spell to activate all of them. So instead of waiting for their time, all the girls who had the potential became slayers. And that's where the show left off. We left with they beat the bad guy, and they're sitting out with the army of slayers. And where do you go from here? You've got women who've come into a lot of power, who do not know what they are and how to deal with them. I mean, be aware that vampires exist. And this next comic book, season eight, picks up right where it leaves off, and she has built the army. She's essentially running a command center. She's running several different slayer teams across the world, which is, I think, a fascinating idea that they just could not have pulled off in the TV show. And there's a bad guy, as I mentioned, named Twilight, who has pulled together, I would call a rogues gallery, several of the bad guys from previous seasons of the television show as well. So you get, like, it's this big story. It's bigger than anything we ever got to see in the show, because you've got four of the guys who are the big bad guys in seasons all together under the tutelage of this bad guy named Twilight. And throughout the season, there's various very funny, very interesting storylines. Her sister Dawn is going through several different curses. She changes into multiple things, starts out giant, turns into like a unicorn or something at some point because she has a demonic spell on her for a one-night stand with a demon. So various things are going on here, and it does definitely have the Buffy flavor to it. It's got the same kind of – the writing, you could tell, is just like it would have appeared on the show. The big twist at the end of the season, of season eight, is that Twilight actually turns out to be Buffy's long-time, long-lost lover, star-crossed lover, Angel, the vampire with the soul. This is, of course, interesting news to her. Angel has good intentions. He's not trying to destroy the world, but he's trying to create a perfect world. And without going into too much long and potentially boring detail for those who just want to read the story, he is almost successful. But in order to stop him, Buffy has essentially shuts down magic to the world. Unfortunately, magic fuels a lot of things in the world. So now we're at the end of season eight, which was the last season before the current one, in comic book form. The world is now left magicless. There are far less monsters, but the ones who are left, the vampires, for example, have gone feral, so they're more dangerous now. And she and Angel, under possession of the powers that be, has killed her mentor, Giles. So we're left at the point where Giles, who we all kind of grew up with throughout the TV show, as the father figure, is has his neck broken and is now dead. And Angel, the person who has spent 100 or so years atoning for his sins as a vampire, who's just a bucket of guilt all over, has now a very big death on his hands that was admittedly beyond his control. But so now we're left with a very dangerous world now. As we go into season nine and, of course, season six of Angel, which started this year as well, very, very big, very big happenings and just game changes across the board and things they just could not have done in the television show, Stephen. And I think for those who are Buffy fans, if you have missed out on any of this stuff so far, and I'll talk about season nine and of Angel and Buffy respectively in just a moment, but for those who aren't reading it yet, there's trade paperbacks available across the board for all of season eight right now, and probably a few of season nine. Get into it. If you love Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel, you're going to love this. This is exactly what it was supposed to be on the television show, but bigger and better. And probably not something you read, right, Stephen? Probably not something you have read a lot of yet.
No, but
I have to
beg off on two counts. One, despite my love of Blonde and Sarah Michelle Gellar, I wasn't able to be drawn into a genre, which I know that a really good-looking blonde protagonist has nothing to do with your love of the show, Jason. I mean, far be it for me to suggest such a thing.
It helps.
But
admittedly, it helps.
But I've never been interested in the vampire genre. And I was chuckling at myself when you mentioned Twilight, which is a rather unfortunate name for that character, given the current tie-in with other vampire franchises. So I love Joss Whedon. I love what he does and other things. It made me think, wouldn't it be great to do a Firefly comic between the end of the series and the movie? Or maybe past the movie, if people, I know a lot, there's a school of thought that wants to argue that the movie, that's the end of the story, and I might go with them on that. But if this format works for Buffy, I can't think that we're the people, you and I, sitting here thinking, well, couldn't we do this with Firefly? I'm sure about 10,000 people have told them that. There was a very short-lived 3-issue run on Dark Horse for Serenity some time back. So with Joss Whedon successfully doing this with Buffy, I would love to see him maybe go back to some of his other work, and maybe some stuff that was never successful on TV. Although someone might say that was the hallmark of Joss Whedon, except Buffy would be the big rebuttal to that.
I would totally agree with you on that one, Stephen. It's pretty funny you mentioned Twilight as the character's name. Maybe I'm a little dense, but I didn't really put that together at first. But now that I think about it, from a story perspective, I have to wonder if that was semi-intentional. I have to wonder if it was something that Joss Whedon, with his humor he has, brought in a character named Twilight, who happened to be a vampire in the end, who is much more dangerous. I will tell you this, and I'm not going to try to convert you into, I will, but I won't do it now. I won't mess with the reader, or the listeners, about converting you into Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But I will say this, admittedly, the vampires in the title, there's vampires who are major characters, but the show is not based around vampires. It's not Twilight vampires. The vampires are scary creatures, and she deals with demons, and every kind of mythological monster you could think of has been in the show and the comic series at some point. So it's more of a monster book, I would say. I was somewhat even argued that that's not the point at all. It's more, and I would think I would agree in some level, that Joss Whedon was really writing a coming-of-age story for kids, teenagers, and what girls, women go through when they're growing up. Every episode of the series could be tied into an event or an issue that teenage girls probably deal with. Which, it's funny now that I mention that, like, yeah, I'm a big fan of a show that speaks to teenage girls. What does it say about me? But it works on many levels as a show. I will say that. It's not just about that. But I would love to see. I would be very interested to see if you ever sat down and watched it, if you would really like it, because I think it's something that, knowing what interests you, you might find, if you give it a chance, some interest behind there. Now, who has time these days? I mean, you're reading 33 books a week. I'm probably around 70 every couple weeks. So,
33 books a month, I should say. Not reading 33 books a week.
Sorry.
33 books a month.
Yeah, I'm probably reading. Probably reading about double that then, or close to it. A little over double, actually. I think I'm pulling about 30 or 40 books every couple weeks. So the series itself, obviously, like I said, I would say, canceled before its time. It's got a lot of love behind it. People who were, when I first heard they were actually doing a season 8 of Buffy, of course I looked at TV Guide, is it on TV? It's not. And I questioned how it would function as a comic book. And I have to tell you, I think it's a very amazing idea. And you're right. I guess the question I have, and let's talk about this for a second, why didn't Serenity work? Why do you think Serenity didn't work? Why do you think it didn't keep going?
I have to say, I haven't done as much research into this. We faced some of the same questions on another show that I hosted on Dread some time back on Swords and Space, which is another show on our network. Mm-hmm. But some people say it's bad marketing, bad time spot, bad network. But I think ultimately, good shows get found out if they can last long enough. And I would say Friday Night Lights would probably be the best example of this. Everyone always said it was the best show on television that nobody knew about, and it just managed to plod on season after season. And now a lot of people look back on 5 seasons of Friday Night Lights and they see it's an amazing show, not just about football, In fact, primarily I think about other things other than football. And no one gave Firefly that chance. I think it was, a lot of people loved it, and in an age driven by ratings and accountability, you sometimes, it's like running a business. You know, sometimes all a new small business needs is a little bit of runway. It needs a little bit of time to grow out of the seed and make it past the dirt and get into the sunlight. So I ran into the same issue with Kyle Killen, who wrote Lone Star, and his show got canceled after not that long, and he put together another show, which is on NBC, which I think I tweeted about every single week, which was called Awake. And again, an excellent show, but it was doomed for cancellation, but was critically acclaimed all over the place. And I think that's the problem, is if something can last long enough, and Firefly was only given 11 episodes, it could have turned into a hit. And I think whoever was producing the show now, with the fact that it managed to produce a movie that was profitable just out of nowhere, just out of 11 episodes of a canceled show, is sort of thinking back what a dumb move it was to cancel Firefly. The fact that, you know, people watch those 11 episodes over and over and over, I think we're either going to see, I think with all the cachet that Joss Whedon has from the Avengers and will continue to have after the Avengers 2, we might see a web version, a web series of things. I don't think the Firefly ship has sailed. I think, and especially with what you talked about today, with what's going on with Buffy, I think we've got, I'm gonna hold out hope. I'm gonna light a candle and hope for something along those lines with Serenity and Firefly.
Well, sure. Yeah, and what's interesting about that, about Serenity and Firefly, as you said, I mean, right now, those are probably, and I would say my generation of growing up, that's probably the biggest cult hit out of a TV show that I can name off the top of my head. What got canceled but is bigger now than it was when it was actually on the air? Firefly has topped that list. It's just a great space western, that's the best way to describe it. It's a space western, and that's not something that I would normally buy into, but I watched it, of course, after it was canceled. I found the DVD just fairly cheap, and I started watching. I'm thinking, this was a great show. Is it still on? And of course, it's absolutely not on anymore. And Serenity, oh, that was a good movie. That was a fantastic movie. And I would love to see, as you said, the continuation between the series and the show would be interesting, but I want to see what happens next. I would love to see that. And I think we as fans, sometimes, we've talked about this before, sometimes as fans, and I'm definitely guilty of this. I didn't read the Firefly comic books. I wasn't even aware they were out. Maybe that's a problem. We're just not aware that these things are happening out there. And that's why we're here to help you today. Sorry, the Buffy the Vampire Slayer is still on the air, so to speak, in comic book shops every day, every week. So catch up. But as you said, it's a business.
Yeah, I might add, Star Trek, the original series, was canceled and turned into the biggest thing ever. You know, so as I, you know, it mm-hmm. wasn't quite as long as the cycle has been on Firefly. But it's in good company if it's a show that has taken on its own life after they've stopped producing new episodes. You know you've got something good. So clearly that's going on with Buffy. And Angel,
I think Angel has
a TV show for a few seasons as well, right?
I'm going to be talking about that. I won't spend a lot of time longer, I swear, because I know sometimes we don't want to. You may not care about Buffy and Angel, but I want to tell you guys a little bit about that too before we're done here today. I feel like a preacher on the Joss Whedon church here today. Let me tell you a little bit. Have you accepted Angel into your life today? Let me tell you about the casting of Angel. But I think we as fans, we have to be very careful about, we could talk about how much we want some of the stuff back, but we have to be sure to support it if it comes back. I think that's important. Right now, Buffy and Angel are doing great. If we do get another chance to swing at Firefly, we better take it and love it. You know, if we want it back, I would even just take another movie. But I think that movie was an amazing, if I got nothing else, it ended in a very good spot, despite what some people might think. But I think I'm surprised. It feels like anything that Joss Whedon can touches turns to gold, so to speak. And that's one that didn't, but it did afterwards. It's just not getting enough love as it is. But anyway, let me tell you a little bit about what's going on with season 9 of Buffy and the new Angel comic book, which takes place after his show. Currently in season 9, so we left off earlier in our conversation that Buffy had destroyed the link to magic in the world, living now in a world with no magic, which of course affects her friend Willow, who you may remember as being played by Allison Hannigan, who is in How I Met Your Mother now currently. Very interesting character, a witch who now doesn't have any powers. And the vampires are no longer, I would say they're no longer sentient. They're just feral animals now, and that makes them more dangerous because they're spreading this vampire disease to others much quicker. They actually call them zompires in the book, Stephen, because they're essentially zombie vampires. They don't think, they just eat. And unfortunately, they're like cockroaches. They just keep spreading. And, you know, when they bite people, when they don't get them, they just keep making more. So it's a plague going on that's created because magic isn't there. They thought magic was the cause of all their problems. Turns out magic was needed to keep the world in check, and it's actually destroying a lot of things right now. But I think what's interesting and why I want to talk about this season is that they dealt with some things. For example, a very controversial issue came up in one of the issues of Buffy. That's something that young adults may deal with, and even teenagers, I suppose, and really anybody. And that's that Buffy has an unplanned pregnancy. And talks about having it aborted. And again, this is a trademark of the Buffy the Vampire stuff. She deals with things that are very delicate and tough issues to deal with for women today. Not being a woman, I can't speak to how hard it must be to make that kind of decision, but I think this is a good, it speaks to, I was surprised that when I talk to Buffy fans, usually they're more often than not male. Which surprised me because I think that as a series, this show had a lot to offer and the kind of, hey, I know what you're going through kind of aspect to women. Of course, Buffy turns out to not be, this, convolutedly enough, it's actually a Buffy bot, kind of a life model decoy of Buffy, and she's not actually pregnant. She's not actually Buffy. She's one of her buddies, those who know the show, named Andrew, switched her mind because her body was in need of healing, and that was his best way of protecting her because she knew she was being hunted, put in a robot body where she can't be killed per se. He did this without her knowing, so that causes some problems. But anyway, so she's dealt with this one very major, and actually it caused quite a bit of uproar on the various forum boards and letter pages for the she was going through that. I think everybody had an idea of what Buffy should do in that case, and I thought it was fascinating because that's just one thing. I could tell you that, like, when you're growing up, Josh Whedon puts a lot of metaphorical situations into Buffy the Vampire Slayer. For example, the evils, what happens when you first become sexual, you know, and how men can be sometimes with women after, and in her case, obviously it's a little worse than it really is, but the first time she has sex with Angel, he loses his soul and becomes evil. I think that's an interesting take on what can happen after sex. Sometimes men get evil. But in his case, he really got evil. But I think it's so interesting to look at that series and even the comic book and know that there's sometimes just deeper meanings that you can take away from it and think about. And I think all of you who listen or watch Buffy and read it, you know what I'm talking about already. But for those who haven't got into it, It's a 7-season-long show followed by a comic book epilogue so far, 2 seasons. Definitely worth a look, and I think for those who like to look for some deeper meanings and things, Joss Whedon has a very good way of putting it into the show and not making it feel contrite and unneeded. It fits in, and I think it's fascinating. When we last left Angel in my discussion earlier, he had killed Giles unwillingly and, again, has another very big death on his soul now that he's received it back. Again, just an even huger bucket of guilt. And he is now working with Faith. Faith, who was played by Eliza Dushku in the television show. They are working together in England. That's where he's based now, in London. And they're working out of Giles' old house, and Angel's trying to resurrect Giles. And I want to talk about this. I know we've already talked about it about Buffy, but I want to talk about this just because I want to reassure fans who say, Giles is dead? He's working to resurrect Giles from the beginning because he knows he did something very wrong and he's trying to put the world right again. Angel is. And I can tell you that as of now, I believe we're in issue 21 or 22, somewhere along those lines, he has succeeded. Giles is back. For all those out there crying and hearing because he didn't hear he was dead, he's back now. But what's interesting is he's it wasn't as easy as he thought. Childs has been brought back. This 50-year-old stately English gentleman is now back in the body of a 13-year-old. Giles is as intelligent as he ever was, but he's dealing with his hormones all over again. It's very funny stuff to read in there. And, of course, Angel, one of my favorite characters out of anything. I like it quite a bit. And the show was great. The comic book's great. Just want to talk about Angel for a second and let you guys know Giles is back. Don't worry too much, but it's very interesting to read how he got back because it deals with a lot of stuff that happened in the TV series. A lot of interesting characters are coming in there. And, again, the voice of the writers here feels very true to the television series. So if you're not reading this yet and you're a fan of the shows, get on it. All the trade paperbacks are out now up to, I believe, 5 issues ago. So you get almost to current on trade paperbacks. Of course, the digital applications have it as well. Get on it because you're going to love it. And I'll leave it at that because I don't want to – again, this is much like Hawkeye for Steve, and I don't want to go on and on about something, so I'll stop right now. So let's move on to our next topic. Steven, the next topic we're going to talk about is going to be Chew, which I know is something that you have not gotten into yet. You might plan to in the future, but not currently reading this. For those who are just joining us again, this is the Culture of Comics podcast. This is your host, Jason Frazier, co-host Steven Heiner, and we have talked about Saga, Fatale, and, of course, Angel and Buffy the Vampire Slayer, seasons 8 and 9. We're, of course, on the AMDG Radio Network. We're also going to be available on iTunes shortly after the show is over. If you're listening, thank you very much. We are now preparing to talk about Chew. And what do you know about Chew, Steven?
I know that it has some sort of challenging aspects to it. I think you had referred to adult earlier on. I think this has to do, though, with, someone like myself who's not, let's say, an Evil Dead 2 devotee, where gore is at the forefront of a book. You won't find any gore. I don't watch The Walking Dead. I don't read The Walking Dead series. And I suppose that's probably pretty mild. All I know is that Chew has some of those aspects for it. It's a post-apocalyptic, which is its own super genre right now. I think
indeed.
It's a very I know that, but other than that, I don't know too much about it. I like the listeners and who are ignorant about the book. I'm going to, sit at your feet today and listen a little bit to what this book is all about.
Well, I think your ignorance in the best way. I think what we always want to reiterate here is we talk about books. They may not be for everybody. We're not trying to sell every book to everybody. But I think it's interesting to hear what else is happening out there in the comic book world as well. And this is a very interesting book that, admittedly, I was not reading until we began to talk about our next plans for the next independent show. And I am now a fan of this book. I'm reading it month to month. I've started putting it on my pull list again. But let me tell you about the world of Chew. And it's, of course, made by Image as well. So we have discussed 2 Image books today, maybe even 3. Actually, 3, huh? Oops, sorry, gang. We will get to some of the other publishers, I swear. There are so many independents out there that it's difficult to know where to begin. And, again, if you're listening to the show and you'd like to hear something discussed, or you have suggestions on what we should be looking at, we'd love to hear from you because Steven and I, we can't read everything. And I'll tell you what, if you give us some good suggestions, I'd be glad to take a look at it and talk about it and even maybe have you join us and talk about it. Give us a call, give us a message, let us know what you think, what we should be reading, and what's wrong with you? Why aren't you reading this book yet? But anyway, Chew is a book that, again, does deal with a particularly challenging issue in and of itself, and that, as you said, can be the gore and kind of the gross-out aspect because the book is, as you said, post-apocalyptic. There's nothing funny about post-apocalypse, but as apocalypses go, this one's a little goofy. The world isn't over, but they went through a devastating plague caused by the bird flu. Killed 23 million Americans. And you're thinking, what's funny about the bird flu? Nothing except now they've outlawed chicken. You can no longer eat chicken in this world. That is worse than heroin and cocaine and marijuana, everything. You can't do anything, You can probably get away with that, but if you eat chicken, you're going to go to prison for a long time. If you eat it, if you sell it, apparently chicken is the vector point for everything. So the leading authority in the world now, it's not the FBI, the CIA, United Nations. The primary law enforcement agency in the United States, at least, is the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. And when I was reading this description before I jump in, I'm thinking, what? This is, so I'll tell you up front, this is a weird book. It's got some great ideas. It's very funny. But when you, if you're just reading the back of the first trade, you're like, what? The FDA, huh? And they're like, they have all the resources, and they're the primary law keepers in the world right now. Or again, I keep saying the world, the United States. But the story follows a police detective named Tony Chu, who is a, I believe it's pronounced SIBOPATH. Let me tell you, a SIBOPATH is a superpower, so to speak. And what you're going to find unique about all of these superpowers in this series is that they all relate around food.
That's interesting,
like Tony.
Chibus in Latin means food. So that's where that comes from.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. Very interesting. I'll read some of the other powers to you here. I'll give you a list, Stephen, and see if you can match them up at the end here when we get done. Because there's quite a few. And I think it's fascinating that they have decided to make superpowers their existence, so to speak. But they all revolve around food, and I think that's just, I think this book is very food oriented. It's kind of funny like that. But anyway, Tony is a detective who's plucked from obscurity, so to speak, because of his skill. And as a SIBOPATH, he is able to, how do I want to describe it? He is able to see he can take a bite from anything. And he gets a sense of what happened to that object. So, the reason this makes him a good detective and why he's able, he actually picks up a serial killer in the first issue because he is attempting to bust a chicken establishment, and he orders I think it's a bowl of chicken noodle soup or something, and tastes a person in it. Tastes a person, and he determines that the chef of this restaurant is a serial killer, who is supplementing his chicken dishes in this underground. It's kind of funny. It's a chicken speakeasy, basically. People go and, like if you do with alcohol, they go and they go with chicken nuggets at the speakeasy. This is, I think, some of the part that could get challenging for some is essentially in some aspects, it deals with cannibalism, which is, again, a very taboo issue in the world as it is. Not that Tony enjoys eating people, but sometimes to solve a case, he might take a bite out of somebody. Figure out what's happening. Because, again, if someone's lying, he can bite them and see what they know. So now he's out solving mysteries as a FDA agent around the world, biting, eating things that you would be disgusted by, just absolutely disgusted, rancid meat and dog. You know, things that, as you said, the gross off factor is there. I will say this, it doesn't necessarily show, and it isn't as graphic as it may sound, Stephen. So while there are some aspects that could be probably pretty gross, I wouldn't say that it doesn't show him eating and enjoying some of these things. It just implies that he has done so with a panel that might say chomp or something like that. And if the implications disturbed you, then that would still be disturbing. But it doesn't necessarily show that stuff on panel. There's some fascinating, just amazing characters throughout the series. I know he's got Tony has a partner who the serial killer from the first issue I was speaking of gets hit in the head with a meat cleaver. Comes back a few issues later as a cyborg. So we've got a person who can eat things and see what happens, and then we've got a cyborg. Looks kind of like a Terminator a little bit, and he's a very funny character. Tony's got a sister and a brother who all kind of have superpowers around food. There's a bad guy, I believe his name is, what is his name? He's the vampire is what they call him. And I liken the vampire to being like, did you watch Heroes, Steven? That show Heroes?
Season 1 and Season 2. I was told to stop after
watching
Season 1, and I stopped after Season 2.
you really should have stopped at Season 1. They're right about that, but that's a whole other topic. So the vampire is like Siler. He's like Silar. You know, he gains powers from eating people. So he's going around gathering these food-based superpowers from around the world by killing and eating the people who have the powers. So he actually is someone who revels in cannibalism. And I can tell you that he actually most recently killed Tony's darling sister who was a NASA scientist, and she had the food power too, and she was a really, I would say, kind of a cute character. She was a lot of fun. She was funny. Unfortunately, so when she died, she really died pretty abruptly. And so that now that Tony currently is on the hunt for the vampire, I know that the writer of the book has and I believe the writer, who is the writer? John Layman. Intends this to be a 50-issue series. I believe the current issue is up to 33 or something along those lines. So we're getting close to the end already. And what I like about this, the way they've laid this out, Stephen, and about many things, is even TV series, which we talked a lot about today, I like when they have a definite end as well. Sometimes, because you get a more solid story out of things that have a definite end, things that we plan on going for another 50 years, you're not going to see an end for. But in this case, we know that he's building to something. Everything means something in a 50-issue series of a book. So we're getting close. We're over halfway through this series. There are at least 5 trade paperbacks out currently. Very interesting art. I don't mean interesting in a bad way. Like, ooh, it's interesting. That's the best I can say about it. I like the art. It's very simple, but it's also very, in many ways, it's also very detailed. Very, very good story so far. There are some gross out aspects here and there, but it is fascinating overall. I think it's a book worth reading, just because we get to see investigations done from a very unique perspective. Again, all basing around food and the superpowers that come from that. So, again, another one that I think Image is really knocking a lot of books out of the park right now. This is another one that I should be reading this book over a year ago. I did not jump on it, and I agree that I probably should have now, because this is another one that I've added to my pull list, along with Saga and Fatale, more recently, because they are very, very different from what you might read in the Marvel and DC side. And, again, challenging. That's the word of the day in Steven and Jason's Playhouse. Today is the word challenging. Every time you hear it, you got to scream. But it's very cool, and let me just go through here, Stephen, and tell you about some of the other superpowers they have. Because again, I think it's just fascinating. It all bases around food. It's such a quirky concept, and it's unique to this book. I don't think anything else is doing it right now. And I might pronounce a lot of these. I have a list in front of me here that I was doing before the show. They have a person who is a Sabo Scrivener, who can write about food so accurately that. The sensation people actually get the sensation of taste when they read about it, and that's actually Tony's girlfriend who can do that. And what's funny, Stephen, is that Tony's girlfriend has that power, and she's also the food editor for a newspaper in San Francisco out there. And so it's funny, she gets so tired of her job that she decides to have fun. She starts writing about the most. She goes to the restaurants that have the worst ratings in the city, the most awful food. And writes about that. So when people read her article, it's very funny. There's actually an issue dealing with this. People all over the city are throwing up. It's like just a massive, people read the paper just vomiting because they're just tasting the worst food they could think of at this point. And she's just doing it for kicks because she's bored. You know, everyone looks forward to her article. Like, they can literally taste the steak on the page, so to speak, when they read about it. And so she decides she wants to make the whole city sick, and she does it. And I think it's kind of funny. it's unique, to be sure. They have somebody who can communicate through food, so they can translate like plays into food, communicate through food that way. Someone who gets smarter when they eat, so someone who becomes a genius the more they eat. So they actually stuff.
Wow, I'd be brilliant if I had that superpower.
In this book, Stephen, what they do with this guy, because it's not like he doesn't stay smarter. He, you know, as he digests, obviously he loses his intelligence. So they just stuff this guy with food and just to keep him going. And when you first see him, he's a fairly skinny dude, but they come back to him later on to try to get some information from him, and he is just gigantic. So you're thinking, he is the fattest genius I've ever seen in my life at this point. It's very funny. There's a gentleman who can actually write mind-controlling messages in the foam of your coffee. another very interesting power. There's a person who can sculpt chocolate. Only chocolate. He can only do this with chocolate, Stephen. He can sculpt chocolate in anything. He actually sculpts it into the working weapons, like a working chocolate laser gun. So, again, it is the weirdest book you're going to read, but when you're reading it, you're like, you know what? I like it, though. A person who can see the future of any living thing that he eats. person who takes the form of the last thing that he ate. So again, there's more. There's so many more, but those are just some of the powers you're going to see other people have in Chu. And so again, to wrap up Chu a little bit, it's kind of a very funny book, from a almost like a CSI, but from a funny kind of place that deals a lot with superpowers and food, and again, chicken being the heroine of a new age. So it's ridiculous as it sounds. And every bit as good as it sounds, too. And I hope some of you, if you aren't reading it, at least take a peek. And again, let me point out this as well. Chu, the first issue, is available for free on the Image Comics application as well. So again, give it a peek if you're interested. Take it out for free. And then if you like it, jump on board. And maybe we could talk about it again in the future. But it's a fun, I genuinely enjoy it. I'd love to come back to this book again, Stephen. I'm putting a notate this. After issue 50, I'd like to come back to this and talk about it again and see how it all wraps up.
I mean, definitely falls into the horror genre for me, because a world without chicken, I just don't even know if that's a world worth living in. I mean, that is my single favorite protein. It would be horrifying just to read it, just to think of that future, you know. That is my heroine now. So.
Well, you'd get in trouble in this world. You'd eat a chicken nugget and go to prison. So you'd be careful. It's a great book, Stephen, and I know the Girl Stuff Factor is there for you. I would say if you have even a little bit of interest in hearing about it, even you, Stephen, check out the first issue on a digital app. Take it out and see if it's for you or not. It may not be for you, for the Girl Stuff Factor. Again, there's some things there that happen that are arguably pretty gross. And his boss, at one point, even tried to get him to eat feces, but to try to get him, because his boss doesn't like him. He tried to get him to eat things that he thinks are really, really gross, and of course he doesn't actually do this. So we're not also dealing with a weird German fetish either. But it's interesting. I'd hate to have a boss who was doing like that. But just to summarize there, another great Image book. Image is really hitting a lot of things out of the park right now. And again, as you have heard, with Saga, Fatale, and Chu, three very, very different books. We're talking. This is not a suit. None of these have really been superhero genre. These are all unique, and I think that's what our independent comics can offer us that some of the big ones can't. Is man, you can run across anything. You can look at that shelf and you can see nothing that's similar from the book beside it. I mean, they are just all so different. So for the almost last part of our show, the last book we're going to talk about today is one that Stephen is a big fan of, or was, because it actually brought him into comic books back in the '90s. Let's talk about Exo Manowar and Valiant's attempt to bring him back into the new age. And Stephen, I'm going to let you take off with this one.
Well, thanks very much. Jason said, this was the book that brought me into comics in the '90s, and the book that brought me back, I guess, last year is when I came back into the comic book world, comic book universe. Exo Manowar is a story that revolves around Eric of Dacia, who is a 4th century Visigoth. For those of you needing a bit of a history refresh, at the time of the decline of the Roman Empire, around the 3rd and 4th centuries, we had restless barbarians coming down from the north and battling with Rome. And Arik is of this tribe of Visigoths that is battling with the Romans. The Romans are his mortal enemy at the time. What happens, both in the original Exo Manowar, and you can find both the original and current rebooted Exo Manowar on Comixology. You can also find trade paperbacks. Valiant is now starting to, and I'm going to save some talk about Valiant for a future independent show on Valiant in general. But you can find old, how can I say this? The original Exo Manowar in trade paperback form is either out or going to be put out by Valiant. So if you want to go back and look at the differences from the old Exo Manowar to the current one, I've read every issue of the old. It was a 68-issue run in the old Valiant for Exo Manowar. Anyway, Arik is captured by an alien species who is on Earth sort of planning a long-term strategic takeover, which I guess is what all aliens do. Their world isn't good enough. Their space travel isn't good enough. So they come to our little planet and decide that it's the only thing that that they want or need. And which is an always interesting trope in comic books. We see this with the Collector, in another line of comic books. But anyway, he's captured and he's brought to the alien spaceship. There's a time lapse because of space travel, which is actually a hard science fiction trope that traveling at the speed of light will mess with the fabric of time for you. Arik is trapped on the ship, but, you know, he never loses his fighting spirit, and he's enslaved by this alien species. In the new comic book, in the new X-Men Award, they're called the Vine, which has nothing to do with a video app for your iPhone. They're a spider species, and very well drawn. It's sort of anthropomorphic spider, a spider that can walk on hind legs and have a humanoid form, and they have the ability to transmutate into human form, whereas deep down they are vine. And they're able to communicate over a subspace psychic network, so they can go into sort of teleconferences light years away from each other. Arik runs into an armor, which could easily be called, if we want to use Iron Man terms, the Mark 7 million, okay? Because, I'm sorry, but Jarvis and Iron Man don't got nothing on the Exo-Manowar armor. The Exo-Manowar armor is a sentient being that generates a certain number of thousands of years at a time. It grows from a seed, and it chooses a champion. So what the Vine would do would have champions, the best of their spider species, fight to the death, and then they would claim the armor. What would happen is the armor would then mold itself to the host. Now, the issue here is the armor is sentient and is worshipped as a god by the Vine. So they respect whatever the armor chooses. What has happened, though, for a long period of time is that Shannara, which is the name of Vine armor, which is the most powerful armor in the universe, potentially. Shannara has rejected all of the Vine warriors, so the Vine warrior the armor would meld, and it looks much like the liquid metal version of Iron Man suits, where it sort of molds to the wearer. So if you are an elephant, a sentient elephant, and the armor were to go on you, the armor would mold itself to your elephant form. And so the armor has, after a short amount of time, I think, probed the consciousness of the warrior, has decided whether it is worthy or not in sort of Thor hammer style, Mjolnir style. But it, unlike Mjolnir, which just won't let you pick it up, Shannara will kill you if you're not worthy, and then withdraw itself into a ball, which is the armor's sort of default setting if it's not on the wearer. Well, Arik breaks in, and again, you'll have to read the book, but he gets a hold of the armor, and guess what? Does it kill him? Which causes a lot of problems for the Vine, both in their theology and in their military strategy, because Shannara is a beast military, possessed of unbelievable armor, unbelievable weapons and technology, which we're not entirely sure where the power source is from, other than, again, Shannara is a sentient being and it must derive its energy from somewhere, but manages to take out large parts of the fleet. And where we find Arik now, as he's finishing up a story arc called Planet Death, is it's not enough that the Vine took away his whole life and brought him out into deep space. But now they're trying to take over the planet, take over planet Earth, because he has possession of Shannara. And so the Vine are accelerating their invasion plans for Earth. And, of course, you can see there's a parallel for Arik with what happened to his family during the Roman invasion. He sees the Vine as the new Romans, and he goes out to Loam, which is the home planet of the Vine, to completely destroy them. Two complications here. One, the Vine may have a home planet, but they have colonized hundreds of worlds. So destroying the home planet is not going to destroy the Vine, just like destroying Vulcan isn't going to destroy all Vulcans. as long as there's one Vulcan left, I suppose. So in the same
yeah.
sense here, there's a discovery of, oh, crap, there are other Vine worlds. That's sort of an open question in the current issue. And believe it or not, because of the space-time travel issue, there are descendants of his family. You could say his people, maybe not directly his family, but there are descendants of his people working as slaves on Loam. So we're left there with the confrontation of Arik with the finest military forces of the Vine. And I'll leave it there. I think I've already done a fair amount of spoiling, but hopefully it'll get you to read the books. Fascinating, hasn't disappointed, was the reason I returned back to comics, and is doing, I think, what Valiant did so well in the 90s, and again, continues to do. It's got a very small universe. We're talking about 6 books. I mean, you could tell people you read the entire Valiant universe and be, you know, one, you could be Tuesday in Jason Fraser's comic book shift. 6 books, and you could read the entire Valiant universe. And what Valiant, like Marvel, does really well is not allow their heroes to be isolated. Everyone is connected. Valiant, from the beginning, both in the 90s and today, in fact, they're doing their first major all-book crossover at the end of the year called Unity, but it will show how the entire universe is connected. Now, the reason why that's not as ambitious is because you only have currently 6 books in the current Valiant run. If Marvel tried to do something like that where every single book was connected somehow, that would, I don't even know how long that would run. But Valiant's able to do that, and I think that's sort of an ideal situation. What if you had a smaller Marvel that was a bit more focused? We alluded to this in our last Marvel show. We talked about Guardians of the Galaxy as a concept versus the Avengers. I think that's what this brings to you. So why am I fascinated by this book? Probably the same reasons I like Iron Man. I love the idea of an armored suit to give you superpowers, since you're not an alien that's born with them. I like the idea of the relationship between the suit and the man. What does that mean when I don't have it on? Or what does it mean when I do have it on? It's able to tell him how to speak Vine. So Arik continues to have his intellect raised and his fighting abilities pushed forward. And I love history. The idea behind, and what's coming in the next story arc, which I don't want to talk too much about, what happens when you take man out of time. We get a lot of, I think that's part of the big attraction behind Captain America. He's a man out of time. Well, talk about the Iron Man tech, man out of time storyline, and then throw in really great historical context and a science fiction twist, and you've got Exo-Manowar. And it's still my favorite read. It's still a book I read the day I get it, and I'm very happy with their current direction. Robert Venditti, who is the writer on Exo, has now taken over for Green Lantern after Geoff Johns ended his nearly decade-long run, and after stepping away from Green Lantern, I am kind of coming back to Green Lantern solely for Robert Venditti. I was not happy with what was happening in the Green Lantern universe, but because I love what he's doing on Exo-Manowar, I'm willing to come back. So that should tell you just how much I love what he's doing writing-wise. And now I'll shut up, Jason, because I think I've probably been talking for about an hour straight.
Well, I'll tell you what, Stephen. I did not read Valiant in the 90s. I was not currently reading it. I actually wanted to bring this in because I knew it was something you would be knowledgeable about, but I went ahead and picked up all the way up until, I think, the first or second issue of Planet Death, which I think is going on right now, as you were talking about. And it's fascinating because, when we talk, and I know we don't want to keep cross-referencing, but at the end of the day, guys, comic books, you can't help but cross-reference. How much cooler is it that Iron Man, in this case, again, Valiant's version of Iron Man, has a freaking barbarian running it, a Conan a barbarian kind of character. instead of a billionaire playboy kind of, I think we know who would win a beer chicken contest with those two. I mean, this guy is a man's man fighter, just brutal, and he gives him the most powerful weapon in the galaxy. You could argue, I think that's, that I found it very, very cool. This is something that I was not reading before. Again, I think I'm going to stick around for at least a few more issues. I'm not entirely sold on it yet, but I'm interested. And I think that's I going in with the expectation that I just was not going to like it because I didn't read it then. I used to think, Diane, who cares? That's a mistake on my part. I think that if you're making that mistake yourself, again, take a peek. I don't think that Valiant has a digital application yet, but it's something where the back issues are fairly easy to get a hold of so far. At least for me, they were. So don't be afraid to dip your toe into this one a little bit and see what you think, because I think the way Steven described it is probably pretty accurate. You got a bigger – it's not as simple as Barbarian gets armor and that's the end of the day, you know. But that's a general conceit or a general explanation of the series, because it is it's going somewhere. And I'd be very interested to see where this is going to be a year from now, especially after this, as you said, this smaller universe crossover, which I think that would arguably be more effective than some of the bigger crossovers we get with some of the other publishers. Steven, I jumped on because of your love for it. I'm glad I did. So far, so good. I'm interested to actually read a little bit more. I know we'll talk more about Bloodshot and Ninjak and Harbinger at some point in the future, so I won't get too much into that, but I'm interested in these characters as well. I haven't even started reading them yet, but I bet... Are you reading those other Valiant books, just out of curiosity?
I am, yeah. And I definitely want to talk about them in a future Valiant show.
And we'll put a lot of focus into that in one of the future shows, and maybe even the next. We'll see. For that being said, again, I'm not the expert in this matter, so I don't want to rate. I think Steven did a great job of summarizing and putting it together for you to give you that little fish hook to jump in on it. I think you definitely should give it a look. Again, I wasn't on board, and I'm now, again, at least going to keep trying it out and see where it's going before I decide, make a final call. But, we're about 12 or 13 issues in now, maybe a little more than that. So give it a peek. Well, I thought for the final part of our show today, we might talk. I know we kind of mentioned some Star Trek in our last independent show since then. There has been a small little movie that you may not have heard of that's come out, and I thought we'd just talk for a couple minutes about that. Now, for the record, all listeners today, you guys should know that we're not going to talk very long about the movie today. Of course, I'm speaking about Star Trek Into Darkness, and the reason we're not going to do that is because Steven and I have already recorded a show on the other show on the network, of course, with host Nicholas Wansbutter, on Swords of Space that was done, 3 weeks ago, Steven, something along those lines?
I think so. Yeah.
Maybe two
right
weeks
after,
ago.
Right after the movie came out.
And we spent, I think in that case, that show went for about an hour and a half, almost 2 hours, talking about this movie. So let's just, Steven, if you don't mind, let's just share some thoughts about the movie. And if you want to know more about want to hear more of our thoughts, more in-depth information, a play-by-play, so to speak, please feel free to jump on AMDG Radio Network on a Blog Talk Radio. And check out the show, because I think you'll have some very knowledgeable people there talking about Star Trek. Myself not included. I was the everyman on that one. Steven, of course, is a Star Trek buff, and I think you'd be fascinated to hear some of his thoughts about the movie in that show. But with that being said, Steven, what did you think about the Star Trek movie?
Well, as a Star Trek buff, or a Star Trek buffy, I guess we could say with today's show, as a Star Trek buffy, I love the movie, and I think the consensus on the show was somewhere between 4 and 5. As I think about it more, I just enjoy it more. I like the parallels with the last Star Trek II, the original series Star Trek II, and the acting and how well what happens when people who've grown up watching Star Wars, not grown up making Star Wars, the people who grew up like you and I watching Star Wars thinking it was just the coolest thing ever, or watching Star Trek and thinking that was the coolest thing ever, How about if those people got to be directors and were talented enough to be directors? And that's what you get with J.J. Abrams. And I think that's why he so well manages to pull that together into this movie. We see some of the best aspects of Star Wars incorporated into this Star Trek, but we also see a fidelity to the Star Trek mission, the Star Trek idea, which is, I would say, a bit more cerebral than what's going on in Star Wars. That's fine. I'm very ecumenical on this point. I love both worlds as a Trek warrior, as I like to call myself, and which is its own commentary within the movie. But I do think that if you like the movie, IDW offers you a way to find the origin stories behind the current iterations of the characters. And it's an ongoing, just like what Jason touched on today with Buffy. If you're reading the Star Trek IDW, it picks up I think, 1 week after the movie. Literally 1 week after the movie. So you are going to be reading in continuity, and I think they're going to plan it and space it well enough that it's going to fill you in on the next movie. There will be no gap. And that's incredible. When you can take something that is ongoing and allow the comics to space in between, it would be as if Buffy was going to have season 10 on TV. Well, you've got season 8 and 9 in comic book, and it's driving what's going to happen on the TV series. That's what's happening with Star Trek right now, both in the comic book world and in the movie world. And very excited. It feels like a blue ocean with not a cloud in the sky and plenty of wind, and very excited for what's happening both in the Star Trek and as J.J. Abrams makes the transition to Star Wars, what's going to happen in that universe. So very, very excited about Star Trek.
Very interesting take. I like the blue ocean and wide open sky. I'm looking at that right now, by the way. Looking outside, I'm looking at that thing right now. So, but I would agree. And let me point out for those, when we say a 4 or a 5, that's on a 5-point scale. So we're not saying this is a middling movie. This was on a 5-point scale.
Yeah, that's
a
right.
Very, very strong movie. Some people think out of 10? Well, we liked it. No, but again, we have a lot more in-depth analysis and thoughts in the actual Swords in Space Radio. But let me just tell you, who has not always been the most devoted Star Trek fan, someone who didn't watch the original series, who only recently just started watching some of the Deep Space Nine on Netflix even, I really, really enjoyed the movie. I think, and again, I appreciate that Steven didn't give away some of the stuff that happened in the second movie. We should tell you up front, if you listen to our other show on Swords in Space, it's going to be pretty spoiler-filled. So if you think you want to see this movie, definitely jump out and see it before you listen to the show. But I think pretty fascinating, the parallels between the first. I love that we can say the first Star Trek 2 and the next Star Trek 2. You mean Star Trek 3? No. The new part 2. So I like this cast. Again, I know I make enemies every time I say this, I suspect, but I like this cast more than the old. I can identify with them a little easier. It's a little more built for what I love about the movie, is I think it's built in to allow for new fans, but also it also lets the fans, the longtime fans, really enjoy some things. I think you're going to find a lot of Easter eggs and nods to previous things that have happened in Star Trek. So if you're a longtime fan and you haven't seen it, I don't believe it. I do not believe you like Star Trek and haven't seen it yet, but if you haven't, go see it. If you're just on the fence and you're just like, what should I see this weekend? You want something that's it really is pretty action-packed, but it's also got some very deeper, I would argue, some deeper issues behind it. Then it's also worth a look for you as well. So, like I said,
I could hear the phasers being set to kill as you said that you liked the new cast. So everyone just kind of back away, put the phasers down.
Listen, I have respect for Star Trek across the board. I think what has accomplished is very, very. It's unlike many things. Across the board, Star Trek is a phenomenon. So I am not saying it's a bad thing in any way. I like certain characters and actors or certain portrayals more, but I am not dissing Star Trek. It's a fantastic series. It's done some things that, like I said, as we talked about earlier, a show that's been at one point canceled and has come back stronger for being canceled as a result. So for all you Star Trek fans listening, I'm a fan of it myself. I promise you. If you challenge me to a knowledge contest, a trivia quiz bowl, you're gonna win it. I'm not that invested myself, but I think it's fantastic, and I would not say that there's anything wrong with Star Trek in the least. It's a great show, no matter what you like about it. So, and the movie every bit as good as the other ones. I would argue this part two might even be. Well, no, I won't say that. I won't say that because Star Trek two, a lot of people's favorite movie. So I would say it's at least equal to the original part two. Again, if you want some more information, you want to hear more about what we think about that, please go check out Swords in Space, the Into Darkness episode, and that's about a two-hour conversation about that solely. So I think we're about to wrap up today, Stephen. So I want to summarize again, if you're just joining us, this has been the Culture of Comics on the AMDG Radio Network. Today we did discuss Independence. We have covered a plethora, I would say a pretty huge variety of books today. We talked about Saga, Fatale, Angel, and Faith, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Chew, Exo Man at War, So if you're just jumping in, go back to the beginning and start over again. If you're interested in any of this stuff or you don't know about it, jump in and listen. As always, we appreciate you listening very much. Next show, next weekend, will be our next DC show. We're going to go ahead and call that our Man of Steel edition show. So for the record, if you'd like to hear what we're going to be talking about, we are going to be talking about, of course, the Man of Steel movie, the Superman family of comic books. So, of course, Superman, Supergirl, Superboy, Superman Unchained, Action Comics, and maybe even a little bit of Smallville, because that's another show that I liked quite a bit that they've also translated into another season on comic books, Steven. So could be interesting to talk about. We're going to get into a little bit about a series that has been very fascinating so far, but is also a very, very popular video game that I have actually played quite a bit of, and that is the Injustice universe. And for those who do not know, it's a video game made by the makers of Mortal Kombat, out on your Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3. But DC has also put out a prequel series to this that is showing this very, very interesting alternate universe. And it answers the question of what would happen if Superman said, "You can't control your planet, I can do it better." And so I'll leave it at that, because it's going to be a fascinating conversation, I think. We're going to talk about the game and the movie, or excuse me, the game and the series. We're going to talk a little bit about Aquaman, who is a character that people are probably going to be like, "What? Aquaman?" I can tell you that.
Yeah, Aquaman.
I'm going to spoil a little bit about the show next week. If you're not reading Aquaman, you should be. And I'll leave it at that. The Flash as well. And again, like I mentioned, we're going to be talking about the Man of Steel movie. And so we're going to be talking about some very, very good stuff next week on our DC show. Thank you for listening today. Steven, any final thoughts before we call it a day, sir?
No, as always, Jason, pleasure, and a great opportunity for me to learn from, as I always do, from you, but in a bigger way with brand new books. So might change the way I look at chicken nuggets going forward.
Well, Stephen, likewise, and of course, all of our listeners, thank you very much. Please do not be afraid to reach out to us through Facebook, Twitter. Even at some point, giving us a call on the show and let us know what you think or what you. We'd love to hear your thoughts as well. Very important to us, so please don't be afraid to share a lot of information. Again, this has been The Culture of Comics, and thank you for listening.